The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We're off and running on another broadcast live from our Edstone campus here in the West Midlands of the UK, 1 p.m. European time, or I guess UK time, 2 p.m. in Europe, and 7 a.m. in the great Midwest of the United States, where Americans are going to be getting up and, I guess, many of them voting. So we'll have a few things, I'm sure, to talk about regarding that on tomorrow's broadcast, but not much on that today. I think it's just all over talk radio. We were discussing that in our editorial meeting this morning. That's all that these radio hosts are talking about. It's like it's a campaign rally every day, and of course, we certainly observe and comment on some of these things as they tie in with Bible prophecy, but there is so much more going on in this world today. And I mean, if you happen to look at the Drudge Report over the weekend there in the U.S., there's this pretty crazy story about three prophecies of Christ's return. I mean, there still is a fascination with prophecy, at least among certain groups of people. Not a lot. I mean, most people dismiss prophecy. But this particular story, it comes actually from the UK, the Daily Mirror, and the three signs that they bring out, the signs that we might be coming to the return of Christ, are firstly the birth of a red heifer in Israel, and the second sign, fish near the Dead Sea, and then the third one, a snake wiggling out of the Western Wall in Jerusalem. These are the kinds of crazy stories that get attention and that supposedly show, at least to certain people over certain social media circles, that we're coming up to the end time. I don't even know if it talks about the return of Christ, but this is a sign, and we've had some articles over the years at thetrumpet.com regarding just some of the crazy prophecies of men. And here, so many of these crucial prophecies that Jesus Christ tells us to look for, they're spelled out, as we've been covering even recently with Revelation 17 and other such prophetic passages. Chapter 13 of Revelation, Daniel 2, Daniel 7. Joel Hilliker had an article, Richard gave this to me. I don't remember how, it wasn't that old from what I remember. But he talked about four signs that the second coming is near. And as Mr. Hilliker brings out in his piece, these days there's a lot of talk about the end of days. So you do get some chatter about the blood moons and crazy things like that. And then this latest, as I just mentioned. But here, Mr. Hilliker in the article goes and gives you what the Bible actually says, what we're to be looking for. What are the proofs? Well, as he brings out, the fact that there are weapons of mass destruction, the fact that it is possible for mankind to kill off all of his fellow man. The modern weapons make it possible for us to do that. Another prophecy, the end time Elijah, Matthew 17, Malachi 4, the previous one, of course, Great Tribulation, Matthew 24, and then the end time Elijah prophecies, the gospel going around the world, that's Matthew 24 and verse 14. And then another prophecy, 2 Thessalonians 2, a great falling away from the truth. All of that's to happen just before the return of Christ to this earth, just before Jesus Christ sets foot on the Mount of Olives. Those are four signs covered in Joel Hilliker's piece. Here, the Daily Mirror comes out with three signs that it says proves we're in the end of days, or proves according to certain individuals on social media. Just crazy, bizarre interpretations. Human reasoning, that's all that it amounts to. Well, I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on that, but certainly go and look at Mr. Hilliker's piece. That's really what should be linked to on the Drudge Report. Sadly, it's these crazy ones like the Daily Mirror story. But look at Mr. Hilliker's piece at thetrumpet.com, the four signs that we're drawing near to the return of Christ. Coming up on today's show, later on in the show, I recently finished this long book on Ulysses S. Grant. Last week, I finally got to the very end of it, massive book. But I'd like to just highlight some admonitions that my father made in How to Be an Overcomer. He actually talks about Ulysses S. Grant, and we'll look at some of the lessons from his life, in particular when he headed up the Army of the Potomac there during the Civil War. What I want to focus on primarily here, though, in the first segment is Iran. And we talked yesterday about Louis Farrakhan's visit to Iran and how that this ongoing war that Iran has had with the United States, and he's over there as an American citizen, and I mean, he's basically cheering them on, encouraging them to continue on in their struggle and their fight against the United States, a war that's been going on for 39 years. And as I mentioned on yesterday's show, I mean, you had the anniversary just on Sunday of the storming of the American embassy in Tehran. And here's Farrakhan's delegation there celebrating that anniversary. They see that as a blessed event, taking all of those Americans hostage. That happened back in 1979. This was an NBC report over the weekend, just hearkening back to some of that history from the late 70s and early 80s. Clip number four.
Thousands of Iranians are celebrating an infamous day in history. 39 years ago today, Iranian students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. 52 Americans held hostage for 444 days, an act solidifying the revolution that saw the U.S.-backed Shah gone. Once America's policeman in the region, Iran spun from ally to enemy, starting a Cold War, pitting it against the U.S. and its allies. Iran's reach has been formidable. During the 1980s, it waged a deadly eight-year war with Iraq. Today, they are close allies.
This is where around 2 million Iranian pilgrims cross the border into Iraq. Iran's supreme leader recently said that if Iranian fighters hadn't martyred themselves in Syria, in Iraq, this wouldn't be possible today.
Decades of sanctions have not curtailed the Islamic Republic's impact on the region. Sunni Saudi and Shia Iran have been slugging it out in proxy wars, vying for dominance based on as much ideology as it is strategy.
So that's from NBC News, coming up on that anniversary on Sunday. What it leaves out there, well, it talks a couple of things, actually. Close allies with Iraq, it wouldn't have been possible, so say the supreme leaders there in Tehran, were it not for all of their... they're meddling in those wars over the years. It really just kind of skips over what Obama did to dramatically alter the balance of power throughout the region. I mean, those sanctions were taking effect. That government could have been overthrown in 2009 had the Obama administration gotten behind the uprising. But as we've gone over so many times before on this program, I mean, when Barack Obama came into power, he made a decision to hand over the power in the region to Iran and to distance himself from Saudi Arabia. And so you saw that all through the Obama years. And of course, it culminated in the JCPOA in 2016, effectively anointing Iran as the king of the South. And so a new administration comes on board, Donald Trump, and he's basically snapping sanctions back into place. And that started yesterday. So just to step back and to look at these past 39 years, what a dramatic restructuring. It happened there during the Obama years. This never-ending war, one hostage crisis after another. I think there's something like five Americans who are being held hostage in Iran right now Of course, you had the 1979 incident with the U.S. Embassy, 52 American prisoners. And then throughout the 1980s, something like 25 Americans taken hostage in Lebanon by Iran's proxy, Hezbollah. Who can forget the incident in January 2016, right around the time of the JCPOA, when those 10 U.S. sailors were taken hostage and just humiliated on camera in front of the world. Reuters had a report just a few weeks ago, this is, I guess, back in August, so a couple months ago, titled America's Unending Hostage Crisis with Iran. It says for nearly four decades, Iran has imprisoned American citizens, and for nearly four decades, Washington has strived to free prisoners through diplomacy, force, or persuasion. And then it talks about the prisoner swap that was connected to that JCPOA, the Iran nuke deal. And Obama said this is just a one-time gesture. He let all of those prisoners go to get five Americans freed from captivity. And now, as I say, here we are almost 2 years into Donald Trump's presidency, and you've got at least five U.S. citizens that are being held captive in Iran today. I mentioned yesterday, you know, with Louis Farrakhan's visit, I just mentioned in passing, I mean, you have journalists, you have preachers that go over to Iran who are detained, who are taken prisoner, who are kidnapped. But not so with Mr. Farrakhan. I mean, he's roaming the country. He's on tour. He's one of their own. I mean, he's bashing the United States. It says here in this Reuters piece, there's no easy way to stop Iran from taking Americans prisoner, a tactic Tehran has employed since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. It mentions the 52 hostages that it took that year, and then it says since then it has detained at least 25 American citizens or permanent residents, Reuters found through interviews and a review of court documents and news reports. So 52 in 1979 and 25 ever since. And it's not just America, as this article brings out. They kidnap Europeans just routinely. A 2017 Reuters investigation found that the Revolutionary Guard had arrested at least 30 dual nationals in 2 years. That was a report from 2017. I mean, and none of that stopped. Once Obama finalized that deal and gave them all of that money, the cash in the pallet, once all of the sanctions were lifted, the wars, the terrorism, the kidnapping, it increased. The Federalist had a piece this week on just the hypocrisy. You know, what the press in the States, what they're up in arms over. Even as Iran carries out all of these atrocities. It says, for the latest evidence of Iran's audacious aggression, America need look no further than Europe. And then it just talks about all these Iranian hit squads, these assassins, that are roaming Europe looking for dissidents or enemies that they can take out, that they can target, that they can assassinate. Further on in the article, it says, meanwhile, this past summer, Iranian intelligence allegedly plotted to attack an attack on an event outside Paris attended by thousands, including notable American political figures, such as Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani. In March, it says here, Albanian authorities arrested two Iranian nationals on terrorism charges after they were caught allegedly carrying out reconnaissance on a location prior to the Iranian Nowruz New Year celebration. It says, Iran's unwillingness to take responsibility for these operations betrays its full knowledge that it is acting illegitimately, not just fighting militants, living up to its name as the world's leading state sponsor of terror. the leading state sponsor of terror. And then it gives some history. All of these bombings and assassinations over the years. And then it points out all the things that happen at home in Iran, where the mullahocracy is responsible for pervasive human rights abuses and violently suppressing political dissent, even taking a Washington Post journalist hostage. We heard all about Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian. You had the leftist media up in arms because the U.S., because Donald Trump, to be more precise, has any kind of a relationship with Saudi Arabia. And Mr. Trump says, look, we need that relationship. They serve as a counterbalance to the growing power of Iran in the region. But the press, as we'll see in another article I'll get to in just a second, I mean, they use the Khashoggi murder to not only go after Saudi Arabia, but to go after Donald Trump. Iran, meanwhile, this article says it ranks number one in the world in per capita executions. It seeks to expand its Islamic revolution and subdue rival regimes, not only by threats, proxy wars, and jihad, but also by cyber attacks and information warfare. And then there's all the chants, like you heard yesterday. Louis Farrakhan leading the one yesterday. Death to America, death to Israel. The Federalist says here, stated succinctly, Iran combines the brutal savagery and repression of the Saudis with the subversion and destabilization emphasis of the Russians and the Jew hatred of the neo-Nazis. With its hands drenched in blood of hundreds of Americans dating back over almost 40 years since the overthrow of the Shah and the taking of U.S. hostages at our embassy in Tehran. That has been the history, and it continues right up to this day. Yet, as the article brings out, in the wake of the Khashoggi affair, Russiagate, and the neo-Nazi attack on the Pittsburgh synagogue, there is no such widespread call for challenging Iran. I mean, with these other groups, or nations, or whoever, just constant Saudi Arabia, you've got to cut ties with Saudi Arabia, says the media. You've got to come on strong with Vladimir Putin. You didn't come on strong enough. That was treasonous, they said about Mr. Trump. And then, of course, they're looking for Jew haters because of the synagogue shooting. And yet the greatest Jew-hating nation in the world gets a complete pass. A get-out-of-jail-free card from the mainstream media. This article concludes here. This coddling of Iran and chiding of its foes is inexplicable from the perspective of American national interest, given only Iran poses an imminent direct threat to America and her allies. And the article encourages those who to ask these questions of those who would want to give them a free pass, which is basically the position of the major media. I mean, if you're so keen on punishing dictators, the current president, we've been told, he's cozying up to dictators. Well, if you're really serious about punishing dictators, what about this regime? What about the number one state sponsor of terrorism? If you really believe in preserving Western civilization, if you're a big believer in human rights, then why not denounce this dictatorship, this religious theocracy, religious fanaticism? If you believe, if you're a real believer in fighting against anti-Semitism, then, as I said yesterday, why wouldn't there be more reports condemning what happened over the weekend with Farrakhan's entourage, with the chants? And why appease this this nation of Jew haters, certainly the leadership. Lee Smith had a great article in Tablet last week. I meant to get to it on one of the programs. I just didn't have time. But he writes about this Khashoggi affair from a few weeks back, that brutal murder. You remember some of the details taking place in the Saudi Arabian embassy or consulate, I forget which. But Lee Smith brings out that in his final column for the Washington Post, before he was murdered, Khashoggi was talking about or writing about the lack of free press in Saudi Arabia and in other nations, how that the press is just an extension of the regime, a state-run media. Lee Smith says Khashoggi might have also been describing the current state of the U.S. media. Over the last several years, the press here has repeatedly joined with government officials, including intelligence officers, to wage operations influencing the American public to obtain political goals, just like the Middle East media. See, you see it today. The media, just an extension. Not in this case of the presidency, at least not this presidency, but it certainly was an extension of the Obama administration. And to this day, it's an extension of the deep state. He gets into some pretty fascinating details here. It says, as the Washington Post, it uses Turkey here as an example to begin with. The Washington Post explained that Turkish President Erdogan used leaks about the Khashoggi affair, some true, some not, as a political instrument to target Saudi Arabia's relationship with the Trump administration. So you can't trust Erdogan. He's over there locking up prisoners or kidnapping people and locking up journalists right and left as well. And so in that murder, he sees it as a chance to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Lee Smith says what the Post failed to disclose was that it played a role in Erdogan's campaign. I mean, the U.S. press was helping, in other words. Indeed, in the last few years, a whole swath of the U.S. press and foreign policy establishment that had been openly hostile to the Turkish government suddenly began publishing almost everything the Erdogan-allied media gave them, relaying anonymous leaks from Turkish officials, often secondhand, to American audiences for the purposes of damaging a Trump ally. See, the press, all of a sudden, once Trump comes in, then the press goes after him through this way, trying to damage an ally of Donald Trump. I mean, they never go after Iran. They certainly don't try to drive a wedge between Iran and the United States. Iran, we're supposed to cozy up to, because that's what Barack Obama wanted. Well, it talks about how many journalists Turkey has jailed, all the human rights violations. But then he switches here, Lee Smith does, to, again, the American media. Says for 2 years, the press has been breathlessly reporting thousands of stories sourced to unnamed U.S. officials and promising that the latest development, Russiagate, Stormygate, etc., was certain to topple President Donald Trump. Whether you admire or disdain the so-called resistance, the fact is that a press labeling itself as such on Twitter is one less interested in reporting facts than shaping political outcomes. I mean, if they're wearing hashtag resistance as a badge of honor, what does it say about their reporting, about the objectivity of their reporting? They are there proudly maintaining that they're resisting this presidency. They're resisting. This is the American press, the American media. Says further on here, in the Khashoggi case, the press was playing the part of the pro-Iran echo chamber, originally built to sell the Iran nuclear deal. You remember all about that. Ben Rhodes, bragging about the echo chamber, bragging about how they used the American media to lie to the American people to make sure that that Iran nuke deal was completed. It was all based on lies, and it passed right through Congress, again, based on all these lies. Lee Smith says, for Barack Obama, the JCPOA was a geopolitical instrument realigning U.S. interests with Iran while downgrading the 75-year-old U.S.-Saudi relationship along with the U.S.-Israel alliance. One of Mr. Trump's first moves in office was to restore Riyadh to its privileged place as regional partner. The echo chamber used the Khashoggi affair to target Riyadh in an effort to preserve Obama's pro-Iran policies. Listen to that. It's exactly right. The echo chamber, it's still there. Now it's the resistance. 2 years ago, it was an extension of the Obama administration. Now it's there, and it proudly maintains that it's there to resist. To resist. The echo chamber used the Khashoggi affair to target Riyadh in an effort to preserve Obama's pro-Iran policies. Khashoggi himself was no stranger to the ways of the Arab press. His jobs in Saudi, print and broadcast media, were courtesy of powerful sponsors. One of them, Turk Al Faisal, had been, in addition to the ambassador to the UK. Well, let me just skip down a little bit further. It says, there are two profound ironies at the core of the current U.S. media operation, using the murder of Khashoggi to political ends. First is that Khashoggi was opposed to pro-Iran U.S. policy that unleashed Iran across the Middle East. They were up in arms. He's one of us. He worked at the Washington Post. This is outrageous. Donald Trump should cut off all relations with Saudi Arabia right now. They won't tell you that Khashoggi was very much against the growing power of Iran. Lee Smith says, what the Iran-friendly, think of it, the Iran-friendly U.S. press corps leaves out is that he was also against Iran's Obama-funded war against Syria's Sunni population. And thus, Lee Smith writes, the second irony is that U.S. reporting about the disappearance and death of an Arab journalist who pleaded for media transparency in his own society marks another chapter in the ongoing transformation of what was once the freest press in the world, America's. I mean, we are seeing a transformation from a free press to a press that's just an extension of the deep state. He says, over the last several years, there have been at least three major information operations run through the American media. There was the Iran deal, which premiered the echo chamber. Next was the Russia collusion narrative, using many of the same echo chamber figures, media, and government officials to try to topple Mr. Trump. The latest is Operation Khashoggi, which is both pro-Iran and targeting Trump. See, you wonder why. And again, I know this story is a few weeks old, but it's just like we talked about Friday with the Kavanaugh affair. I mean, it really does expose the attack on America and its institutions. And so does this. Now you see why. In a world where journalists are being kidnapped, there's five Americans in Iran right now at this moment, jailed in Iran. And you see why now, in this world where journalists, where Americans are kidnapped and killed. It happens often. And so why the obsession, or why the attention on this Saudi Arabian resident who contributed to the Washington Post from time to time? Well, because it fit right within that narrative. that pro-Iran and resistance to Trump narrative. This article talks about how that, I mean, even getting into some of the specifics, how that the whole Khashoggi affair shows how that, that MSNBC is the favored destination for CIA leaks. Russiagate, that revealed that the FBI tends to favor the New York Times. A lot of the leaks that ended up at the New York Times. And then the Department of Justice. A lot of the leaks that have come out of that arm of the government, they've appeared in the Washington Post. Pretty amazing insight from Lee Smith at Tablet Magazine last week. Just one final thought here before I switch over to that prophecy in Daniel 11. Victor Davis Hanson, he has an article on CNN's existential war with Donald Trump. And he gives the backstory. CNN, of course, they're infuriated by the president constantly pointing out that they're fake news and saying that they're an enemy of the people of America. But as Victor Davis Hanson brings out, I mean, from the beginning, from the moment that Mr. Trump came down the escalator 3 years ago, I mean, it's been 93% negative. It's a full frontal assault against this president. And Victor Davis Hanson has a section here, "Welcome to the Echo Chamber." He says, "Given the fabrications and outright falsehoods that were critical to the selling of Obamacare, from those of Barack Obama to Jonathan Gruber's, I doubt any credible journalist would have dared state that they could no longer stay neutral in reporting Obama administration policies. What followed the fabrications of Obamacare were Ben Rhodes' later admissions of creating an echo chamber by which he orchestrated all sorts of narratives among incompetent and compliant young reporters." They're incompetent and they're compliant. Whatever you say, yes, we'll echo that. Or Susan Rice's serial lies about the Benghazi deaths, the Bergdahl swap, the complete removal of WMD from Syria, and the denials that she had requested unmaskings of Trump associates swept up in the Obama administration's FISA warrant surveillance. That's CNN. It's existential war with Donald Trump. They're part of that resistance. They have been from the beginning. And so we see a Jeroboam administration taking a much stronger stance in opposition to Iran. But look at what he's going up against still from many leaders in Europe, from this press that will, as I covered yesterday in a different way, I mean, here they search far and wide on the internet. Sam just gave me an article today, 11,000 words over the weekend, delving into the subject of white supremacists and so on. And then the Khashoggi affair. Here's one. It fits. We can drive a wedge between the administration and Saudi Arabia. We can go back to like it was during the echo chamber when we were really trying to push Iran along. Well, we know from Daniel 11 and verse 40 that Iran is the king of the south. And we've been saying this since 1994. And so as strong as this stance is, and it is refreshing to see someone coming in, and my father called it the worst foreign policy deal in American history. And so to see that rolled back, I mean, that's a good thing. But we still need to see where this or how this plays out. And Daniel 11 and verse 40 tells us. Here it's a prophecy between, it's a prophecy about this clash between the king of the south, that's Iran, and then the European king of the north, headed up by Germany. And then the United States, you see, is not even mentioned in that prophecy. So in the end, it's not going to work out well for the United States in this ongoing war against the Islamic Republic of Iran that goes all the way back to 1979. My father's talked about this over the years on his Key of David program. This was him, I think this was following the nuclear deal from a couple of years ago, clip one.
But if Iran's a terror without nuclear bombs, what are they going to be with nuclear bombs? That's why this nuclear agreement, I believe, is the worst foreign policy disaster ever made by America. Or the worst foreign policy deal, and it is just a massive disaster. And you're going to see it very soon. I'm telling you, it won't take long. They've broken over 20 nuclear agreements already, every single one, as I said before, and yet we go ahead and walk into this and act like they can be trusted. They cannot be trusted. They lie as a way of life.
That's him following the JCPOA once it was finalized by Barack Obama. And even if the U.S. is rolling it back some now, there's lots of nations that are not. And so the United States is in a difficult position. I mean, it certainly can make it hurt to some degree. But like my father has explained, I mean, here's the number one state sponsor of terrorism. Listen to what he said in 2011. I mean, this goes back several years. Move ahead to clip three here.
Iran, the number one state sponsor of terrorism by far, has bludgeoned its way into controlling Lebanon and Gaza and has become the backbone of Syrian terrorism. Iran also has bombed and butchered its way into the dominant role in Iraq and Afghanistan and is empowering the Muslim Brotherhood terrorism to get control of Egypt. Now, America and the West have paved the way for another Iranian victory in Libya.
That was from 2011. I mean, it's just been all across the region, not just Libya. But you see the fingerprints everywhere. Another prophecy, and I believe Richard went through this with you on the program last week, Psalm 83. And you can see two camps in the Middle East. You can see the Saudi Arabian camp. You can see the Iranian camp. That was when Richard subbed in last Wednesday or Thursday, I believe it was. So go to thetrumpet.com and listen to those podcasts. All of these shows, of course, are posted at our websites following the live broadcast. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Last week I finished Ron Chernow's book on Ulysses S. Grant. An excellent book, a really long book, if you have the time to chip away at it. It would be well worth it. There's certainly, like any book, I suppose, there's sections in it that are a lot more riveting and inspiring, I suppose, than others. And without a doubt, it was the years that Grant spent during the Civil War out on the battlefield that really are the most, I think, some of the most fascinating incidents in his life. You can learn a lot from his generalship, from the approach that he took out on the battlefield. And of course, when you think about it with respect to what was happening on the other side, Grant was there in the West, which today would be, I guess, the Midwest of the United States, fighting in the West, while the Army of the Potomac, it wasn't going so well for the bigger army out east. And President Lincoln was frustrated. It made for a lot of sleepless and stressful nights as commander-in-chief. After the defeat at Fredericksburg, and if you know anything about the history, I mean, Lincoln was just searching and searching and searching for a general that would fight. So they had another humiliating defeat at Fredericksburg. And then Lincoln appointed General Joseph Hooker to head up the Army of the Potomac. And he wrote this to General Hooker in 1863, early on. He said, "I have placed you at the head of the Army of the Potomac. I believe you to be a brave and skillful soldier, which, of course, I like. The government will support you to the utmost of its ability, which is neither more nor less than it has done and will do for all commanders." He says later, "I shall assist you as far as I can to put it down. Neither you nor Napoleon, if he were alive again, could get any good out of an army while such a spirit prevails in it." He says, "And now beware of rashness. Beware of rashness. But with energy and sleepless vigilance, go forward," he said, "and give us victories." With energy, with vigilance, go forward, he said, "and give us victories." I mean, most of the Civil War up to that point, it had just been, for Lincoln, it was just a long, frustrating search for a general who would fight and lead the army to victory. There's a long list of them. They were too cautious, or maybe too vain, too rash, too many excuses. But that began to change, and it changed in a hurry when Ulysses S. Grant took over the Army of the Potomac in 1864. Last week on Friday's show, I used the example of John Adams to make the point that we're here as spiritual soldiers to endure hardness, to embrace it, in fact. That passage in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 3 through 5, Paul said, "You therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that wars entangles himself with the affairs in this life, that he may please him who has chosen him to be a soldier." It says, "And if a man also strive for masteries," verse 5, yet is he not crowned except he strive lawfully." I mean, we have to strive for masteries. Masteries, it says. Endure hardness. Don't get entangled in the affairs of this earth. There's lots of spiritual parallels that you can make with this, just like we did on Friday's show. But here we are engaged in the greatest war ever. And it's a life and death struggle. And the real struggle, the real battle each day goes on right between our ears. It goes on in the mind every day. And we've got to fight against vanity or being too timid, dragging our feet, complacency, fatigue, rashness, all those things. In the Overcomer booklet, my father says, "God is looking for people who are eager to do battle and go on the offensive." That's what he wants from you. That's what he wants from me. We've got to be eager to fight, to go on the offensive. God's looking for people who will do that, just like Lincoln was looking for soldiers, for generals who would give him victories. And there are so many mediocre ones who wouldn't fight or who made excuses, who had these glaring weaknesses. They wouldn't go forward. Well, as I say, when U.S. Grant took over, the army started moving, finally. But it should have been moving long before he came along. I mean, the North had all the advantages. I mean, their population, it was 22 million in the North. And the South had 9 million. 4 million of them were slaves. So they had 5 million whites to the 22 million in the North. The army, the Union Army, enjoyed a 2-to-1 advantage, basically. It was twice the size of the Southern Army. And it was also set up as really the industrial powerhouse of the two. It had most of the rail networks, the infrastructure that it needed to make more war materials and such. It had more sea power. It had an established government. It had an awesome president. It was one of the best fed armies in history. Like I say, it had everything that it needed to get the victory, to get multiple victories. Now, spiritually speaking, and again, I know we can bog down from time to time with discouragement, or maybe there's certain physical obstacles that we battle against, but just think about what we have at our disposal, spiritually speaking. Paul said in 2 Timothy 1 that God's given us the spirit of power and of love and of a sound mind. You can study into that word for power. It's a word similar to dynamite. Think about the spiritual weaponry that we have at our disposal. Think about the passage in Ephesians 6, the armor of God. God says, put it all on. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Put on all the armor. We're wrestling not against flesh and blood, Paul said, but against principalities, powers, the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness. So we need this armor. But look at what we have. We have the truth. We have the breastplate of righteousness. We have our feet shod with the preparation of the gospel. We have the shield of faith. We have the sword, the helmet of salvation. Sword of the Spirit, Paul says. Tremendous power. Tremendous power. With that kind of power, with that kind of weaponry, with that kind of armor, we should be obtaining victories. If we're close to God, we will be getting some victories. That's what Lincoln wrote to Hooker. He said, look, we need some victories now. Give us victories. Go forward and give us victories. That's what God's saying to you. Well, the Army of the Potomac, as I say, Grant took that over in 1864, and everything changed. Finally, Lincoln used to say that his generals, they all had a case of the slows. They would drag their feet. They would constantly be asking for more reinforcements, constantly waiting for ideal conditions before they'd fight. And then when they'd fight, they'd take a month or two or three afterward to regroup, to rest up, to get ready for the next round. What a difference when Grant came on board and he was just constantly moving forward. Paul says in Hebrews 10 and verse 39 that we are not of them who draw back unto perdition. We don't draw back in God's army. We move forward. We go forward to victories. How many victories are you getting for God? How many victories are you getting with this power that God makes available to us? The Bible says in Revelation that we're overcomers or conquerors. We're here to conquer the devil. We're here to conquer our adversary. Grant comes in 1864, and I mean, his philosophy was it was just to keep the enemy under relentless pressure, to fight whenever the opportunity arose. He was there ready to fight. And there were plenty of other generals who probably graduated a lot higher at West Point, who probably had a lot more talents and abilities, who probably had a better personality. But Grant had the mindset that Lincoln needed. He had the mindset that the nation needed. Historian John Keegan, he contrasted Grant with some of the other generals that Lincoln was so frustrated with, and he said several major Union leaders shrank from making the Confederacy pay in blood for its rebellion, believing that time and a milder way of making war would wean the South into a mood of reconciliation. Grant took no such tepid view. Though not a bloodthirsty man, he believed that only fierce blows would bring the war to an end. And though deploring the effusion of blood, he always fought to win. He always fought to win. He always went for the victory. And it started, once he was switched over to the Army of the Potomac, I mean, it started with the very first campaign. And he just tore into the South. He headed into Virginia. He started fighting. He turned General Sherman loose on the infamous March to the Sea. I guess infamous from the Southern perspective. He just started marching his way through the South, the Southern heartland, burning crops, destroying railway infrastructure, splitting the Confederacy in two, basically. I mean, it was a brutal campaign, but it helped to bring an end to the war. As Sherman was carrying on through the South, Grant was moving through Virginia. Constant battling, constant fighting, the Overland Campaign of 1864. Almost 40 days of constant combat. Wherever General Lee went, Grant pursued him. He was in hot pursuit, relentlessly chasing after the South, chasing after Lee's army. And then there was another policy that Grant became famous for. Unconditional surrender. Unconditional surrender Grant. That was almost his nickname. Well, Lee finally did surrender early on in 1865 at the Appomattox Church House. And the war finally was over. Because Lincoln got someone who was willing to fight and to go on the offensive. Someone who finally claimed victories. That's what God wants of us. And he makes the spiritual tools available for us to come on victorious. If we rely on him, if we draw closer to him, if we submit to him, then the devil will flee from us. We can put Satan in full-fledged retreat. If we're really using, relying upon the power of God's Holy Spirit, we have all the power in the universe at our disposal if we're drawing on that power of God. Listen to what my father wrote in How to Be an Overcomer. He said, near the end of the Civil War, Lincoln was finally able to get a man who would fight, General Grant. Lincoln had gone through so many unsuccessful generals. Whenever those men suffered defeat, they always had excuses. Lincoln came to the point where he said, don't give me excuses, give me victories. The nation's about to fall apart. My father says, you have to find somebody who will go on the offensive and achieve results like General Grant did. He slashed his way through the South and unified the nation. God needs leaders in his church, not unlike U.S. Grant, spiritually speaking, fighters, warriors who will go forward and claim the victory. Revelation 3, as I said, it talks about God's saints as being overcomers or conquerors. Lincoln spent most of the Civil War searching and searching and searching for a general who would just give the Union the victory, the unity that it needed. And God, too, will search and search and search for those who are willing to go forward and fight and claim the victory. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.